These are the recollections of Turner Ashby. Memories of the years when the oceans rose and the several states were separated asunder. Chapter 21. I got some new glasses here. See how they turn out.
You all right, Turner?
Peter asked. I'm fine, I said.
You don't seem fine,
Peter said. I'm fine. I waved my hand, but I was not fine. I was shaking. Sweaty palms. I'd never had sweaty palms before. I had no idea. I blinked and I winced. I remember, oh, that hurt. Fire. Oh, it was like a fire. My chip in my head burned right behind my right eye. Burned like a hot nickel. Made my belly twist. I never felt anything like it. I could hardly keep stood up.
Maybe you ought to sit down.
Oh, no need. I'm fine. I was fine, except everything between my teeth and my toes. Well, let me look anyway. That man's about ready to save my life, whether I wanted it or not. Peter Starr was his name. Peter Starr was perfect. He had a certain ease and touch about him with both humans and machines. Those machines of the fast and indulgent ages before the high waters came. He had a feel for digital ware, both hard and soft, and for chips, those chips that were in our heads. He could bring back memory to a machine that had forgotten. He touched a computer like a doctor, and as a matter of fact, he was a doctor twice over. A PhD in bioelectrical engineering and an MD focused on the nervous system. He was interested in how the nerves tied to the chips. Quite a remarkable individual. He'd been sent down to Texas and that billionaire Harry Slaughter with me as a technical liaison for the budding and easily bruised AFIEs and lines of fiscally independent entities. Peter's task was to point out to the industrialists and all those entrepreneurs the financial, societal, and infrastructural advantages of belonging to a loose union of high-minded, like-minded assemblages. We always employed the term loose, so as not to make those billionaires skittish. No billionaire would tolerate being bound in some position where they did not believe they would have final control and, of course, profit. That hurt. No, I lied. Peter had pressed my temple in several places and pulled out a little device a couple inches long and waved it at me. And for a moment, there was not any hurt. There's some frequency messing with your chip, he said. I don't know if it's from local or outside, he pressed again. That better? That is better. Perfect, he said. Yes, that man was perfect. There was only one problem with Dr. Peter Starr. Only one problem. He was engaged to my Lays Fitzgerald. How could Lays have done that? Fall in love with a perfect man made my chip hurt again. I had to hate him. I just had to. Lays had not told me his name. Probably figured I would have sent him some kind of Ebola email or maybe lit fire to a dog turd on his front porch, and I considered both. Lays just told me, oh, I didn't know him, but I'd like him if I knew him. He was an up-and-comer. He was on the AFIE board. He was on a number of boards of hospitals and tired power corporations. He was a patron of the arts. He was a patron of the sciences. What was left of both those lost disciplines. He filled sandbags on the weekends. Yes, he was a perfect man. He not only predicted trends, he was a trend. There was no doubt he was a perfect specimen of a perfect human being. He's as old as the hills, I phoned Lays.
He's 31. That's not old.
He's as old as the hills, I insisted. He'll wrinkle up and you'll die in about a year.
You watch out for him for me, will you?
Lays said, how could I say no, but I could not even do that. He had to go and look after me.
You up to going?
I got no choice. It was our last evening at the Wine Glass Ranch there in Texas. We were honored guests, along with a few junior dignitaries from Louisiana and a princess from New Hampshire.
We bumped into Harry Slaughter just as the festivities were about to begin. I shook his hand, and I promised to pay my cell phone skeet shooting wages. He remarked that his conglomerate, they might join AFIE, or might not. You'd be one of the first and brightest stars on that flag, I said. We were desperate to sign on a couple billionaires, or three, or four. He asked me how we were getting back to Virginia and if we need any assistance. There's battles out there, you know. Always battles. I said I, for one, was not headed straight back to Virginia. Oh, we all know those reasons. I was going on to Colorado. I didn't know about Peter. I didn't know where he was going. Well, the show's about ready to begin. Now, Harry Slaughter was going all out. He was just giggly, and he always giggling, just giggling to put on some entertainments for us all. There'll be several invocations, because that's what the country of Texas would do. Invocations, one after another after another. Preachers showed up from everywhere, fall, everything. You could not chase them out. How else were they going to get fed? There would be the usual reenactments of rodeo tricks and riding and calf roping and rhymed metered recitations of cowboy poetry, even though the main export of Texas anymore had become the enriched mungo rice that employed thousands of indentures and filled the fields for hundreds of thousands of acres in all directions. Now, peeking west, all you could see was a huge white town salt pile. Now, excuse me. Saline redistribution mounds that were the tailings of the process. Oh, those processes, so many processes. Beyond that, there were the tar mounds and the appliance ranges. Now back to the entertainments. Of course, there would be some country and western singing. And I was so surprised and very pleased to see Willie Nelson was on the bill, still out there doing the billionaire party circuit, 104 years old. Still could sing a fine ballad and play his jazz chords. And besides, anybody who'd written a ditty for Patsy Cline was fine by me. And then there was a promotional video. Everybody likes a well-produced promotional video. I certainly do. And what I did not envision in this variety of entertainments was that there would be a magic show and I would be well acquainted with the magician. So Peter Starr and myself and the rest of the guests sat down to a spicy but oddly mungo-tasting Texas meal and were transported into the realm of the wild and the para-believable by Sir Sterling and his East Texas techno-crawlers, whose only and sole aim was to transfix and amaze his worthy audience with simple yet elegant illusions of both the mind and the digital. Oh, my, my. Oh, we were transfixed. Well, I've always been a sucker for that nonsense, and I've always been even more of a sucker to fix my eyes on the magician's fetching. Oh, that's such an odd old bygone word. Fetching assistant. Who always seems to be called Crystal or Sabrina. But this particular sister was introduced by the mighty Sterling Bowen. It's little Astoria. Oh my again. My little Astoria. Well, there were puffs of smoke and aces up the sleeves, knives flying, and Sterling Bowen's almost complete syntactic reduction of verbal assault on the English language. He and his assistant took a bow. Pretty something, huh? Harry Slaughter, our host, slapped us on the back. Oh, my, yes, indeed, I gushed, which was pretty much my principal diplomatic tool set, was gushing and praising beyond worthy extravagance. I love that entertainment, and I do love the table centerpieces, sir. Wonderful decorations, I said. Then I thought of an idea. Would it be possible, Mr. Slaughter, to ask that marvelous magician and his sweet assistant to join us for an after-dinner coffee, perhaps a bit of your world-famous Texas mungo pie? Peter Starr looked askance at me. Slaughter looked equally askance at me. One of the cute creoles at the next table looked askance at me. I was triple askanced. "What'd I say?" I said to myself. "Mr. Slaughter, of course, he meant nothing by it," Peter said. "I'm sure he had no idea."
"I believe the indentures would be better off and much more comfortable remaining on their side of the curtain,"
Slaughter waddled off. "We can't go back there, Turner," Peter said an hour later, pulling on my arm. "Oh, yes, we are," I said. I was not going to be deterred from finding my old friends. Peter and I had bid our good nights, and then I planned to slip ever so stealth-like over to the servant side of the billionaire's compound. Now, it depended on the leaseholders of those days. Were not called owners. They did not own human beings. Oh, no, no. This was not slavery, so they said. Carrying the tax and credit debits of various citizens to lift and make a market of their financial burdens was considered a necessary component of a highly organized and evolving economy. And nobody ever argued with the economy. You just can't. The economy is always right. It depended upon the indentured leaseholder about how much security, etc., and compensation, food and lodging, was provided for the indentures. Security didn't seem to be a problem in that part of Texas, oh no. Where were you going to go except to stumble into yet another Mungo field? So there was no security, so Peter Starr and I, we just wandered back into the rows of the tents and the wands, the shipping crates that made up the indent. That was the name, that's what they called it, the indent of the indentured servants' quarters. It was pretty quiet, and we had dressed down. I no longer was sporting my tuxedo. I had basketball shoes on. We soon came upon Sterling Bowan's Winnebago recreational travel trailer, loaded down, oh my gosh, with amenities. Now leave it to Sterling Bowan to get a couple of perks beyond that of the casual indenture. I saw Ed first. I never thought I'd ever see Ed again, my old Ed. I thought he'd been killed in the explosion in that cave in Kentucky when we found the false fair Liza. I did not say a word. I come up behind him, I bear hugged him, and I was not going to let go. And then Claire came out, old my Claire, with a baby. A baby in her arms. Well, I'm a 2-year-old or something, sucking a thumb. I had tears. Sterling Bowan came out, and Lady Astoy, I taught her. She'd been 14, 15 years old. I'd been her tutor for 2.5 years, and I taught her everything I knew about worthless histories and where boundaries had been before they were all washed away. My little Astoy. "I thought you were dead," Ed commented. "I thought the same about you." And then they caught me up on how they came to be at Harry Slaughter's little slice of Texas. Seems Astoria's father, the Earl of Lexington, came into a little trouble. Gambling. Lost his army. Lost his guard. Lost a stable full of thoroughbreds. Now, he had to make amends. Sold what he could. Sold what he had. Sold his servants. Sold his daughter. Maybe she was worth 50 horses. And a regiment. "We're going to have to break him out," I said. "We can't leave him here." "We can't break him out," Peter said. "All hell would break loose."
"Oh, that man is right as rain," Sterling Bowan yapped. "Our contracts, our debts are owned. They's worth money. Can't make a move against money, against commerce. You just ain't done. Especially in your position, Turner. You're a diplomat now. You represent a country. You represent commerce. You have to play by the rules."
"The rules," I said. "What if the rules are immoral?"
"Never mattered before."
"Bias," Astoria said.
"What?" I said.
"Bias. Buy our contracts. Then we can just go."
"I don't think you're going anywhere."
Harry Slaughter came up from behind and with a couple of thugs who immediately pinned Ed down. None of the rest of us were any good in a fight.
"I'm invoking the Fugitive Indenture Act, and since I know you were once contracted to the Duchy of Lexington,
I invoke that I own that contract. I own you, Mr. Ashby. I'm sure you'll make a grand addition to the magic act.
Oh, my head started to hurt again. So how exactly was Peter Starr going to save us?
You'll find out next time. Turner Ashby.